Hello, and welcome to another episode of Theatre Voice, the podcast that gets theatre makers talking. It was Two Piglets that put director Jude Christian on the map back in 2013. Staging a Spanish monologue in which a single father falls to pieces under the pressures of parenting, she cast two black and white baby Berkshires as his demanding young sons. That playful but incisive approach to theatrical representation has made her one of the most daring young directors working in Britain today. And, as she explains to the critic Catherine Love in this week's episode, it gives her work this constant critical theatricality. She's plunged plays into pitch darkness and splashed saffron paint across studio theatres mid-show. Behind all her work, there's this insistence on the politics of representation, in both senses of the word. It rears its head again in her latest project, James Fritz's Bruntwood Award-winning play Parliament Square, a shape-shifting script exploring the efficacies and limitations of political protest. It transfers to the Bush Theatre this winter after its premiere at the Manchester Royal Exchange.
I'm really excited by play texts that leave that demand creativity from designers and directors and performers. And when I say creativity, obviously everything demands creativity, but what I mean is stuff that feels like it's urging you to create things and come up with solutions. And I think I've worked on a lot of texts before which feel quite blank canvas, where you just get swathes of prose or swathes of text, but no stage directions, for example. And that's always exciting, but with Parliament Square, so the first act of it happens essentially inside someone's head. It's a kind of POV, interior monologue, a dialogue between the protagonist and herself as she goes on this journey. And so you get little snippets of the conversations that she's having with people, and you get, it'll suddenly go, oh, well, now we're on a train, and you suddenly jump forward in time. So obviously you can't stage it naturalistically. Trying to find what that space is and trying to find the relationship between the two physical humans who are speaking to each other, it's just an exciting thing to have thrown at you. Then the second act of it has what are much more recognisably scenes. I mean, they're really annoyingly short scenes sometimes. I mean, annoyingly in the sense of like they're annoying to direct, particularly in a space like the Royal Exchange, which is so beautiful. How it serves the play dramaturgically is beautiful because you have a community who are surrounding the action and are witnessing this play in full view of one another, and your backdrop to watching the action is always more people who are watching the action. But it's like a massive ball ache just getting people on and off stage quickly enough. It's one of those things where you're like, oh, I just need to do like really good, clever, grown-up directing and move the scenes really quickly. And then the third act of it is jump cuts. It's like 40, there's like 85 scenes or something, and some of them are 3 words long. And so when I read the play, I didn't know James, and I was like, I simultaneously love and despise this man for writing something that's so exciting, but also is a play full of jump cuts. And I think so I knew from quite early on, I think, that I was going to be collaborating with Fly Davis as a designer, and that felt like a happy place because she and I had worked together before, and I think we both get excited about stuff that... I think what Parliament Square does is it asks you to find a physical environment that helps facilitate people's understanding of what's happening and their engagement with it. So, and because the acts are really distinct, we wanted to make it very clear that the vocabulary was different in each act, but also to find a way of them feeling connected and it feeling like one cohesive play. So those were all the challenges. I've sort of talked about how hard it is and not about how we solved any of it. Is that useful?
Well, I suppose it's difficult to say too much about how you solved all those problems without...
Yeah, it's really hard not to spoiler the whole play. Mm. I think one thing that... for example, I guess one thing that felt really right for Act 1 and Act 3... actually was sort of finding a very gentle way of manifesting people's emotion in terms of their interaction with physical objects, So again, without massively spoiling it, but the first act is about a woman going on a journey which is going to have huge emotional cost to her, and it's about her going on a journey that is taking her away from a very comfortable domestic environment. And so what we decided to do was, rather than in any way try and portray that space literally, what we wanted to have was the presence of those everyday objects in the space, so that the removal of them feels really emotionally significant, feels really like physically painful to her. And we also, so on the team was Jennifer Jackson, who is a movement director and also a director and a sort of brilliant maker. And we also played a lot with the physicality between the two performers who are doing that scene. And they're both great, and they spent quite a lot of rehearsals going, oh, cool, now we'll just wrestle each other while we're having this entire conversation. So, yeah, I think playing with ways of going, what are the markers when, you know, someone's been arguing with themselves and then they suddenly take a huge leap forward in terms of a decision or a life event. There should just be something that moves very significantly in the space that we all suddenly feel that the whole space has changed. And I think that felt important because the reference point that we kept using the most for that act was Inside Out, the Pixar movie. Because basically all of my directing references seem to be Pixar movies, but that one's the one that happens inside someone's brain and it's like in the control centre. And that's when you suddenly go, oh, actually, although it feels quite weird, it's a really recognisable trope. Like, we all kind of get it and we've all seen it in like sci-fi movies or in Peep Show or whatever. As soon as you go, oh yeah, it's from the perspective of the inside of someone's head, everyone can think of like TV and film references for it. But it's I think it's quite a weird thing to have in theatre.
Yeah, I can't think of another example of that in theatre off the top of my head. I'd also be interested in hearing more about the kind of dramaturgical process of working on that play, because I know it was written a couple of years ago and won a prize as part of the Bruntwood competition, and there's James has been doing a lot of work on it since then, and I understand you were sort of involved in that, so could you perhaps talk a bit about that process?
Yeah, I think one of the processes of it was recognising that although the play is something that I think whether you read it or whether you see it, it grabs you on page one and you sort of come out of the other end of it feeling like you've just been on a roller coaster. That's definitely, with making the production, I was like, I really feel the need to serve that experience that I think everyone I know has had when they've read the play on the page. But for something that goes like a bullet, it's got such massive ideas and such massive events in it that a lot of the dramaturgical process, a lot of the development process of it, through workshops and through conversations with various people and through me and James sitting down and looking at it, was about going, let's be really rigorous and let's think really deeply about the plot that happens over the entire course of the play. Because although the play is like an hour and 20 minutes long, the plot stretches over 15 years. And we spent a lot of time just fleshing out what happens in these people's lives. And I think there's a lot of information which then doesn't manifest in the play, but it having been thought through and worked through has informed on what you now get. I think, it's much richer now, even though it's probably as slick and spare as it was when it was first written. It's gone on this sort of mad journey where it became probably 4 hours long and this massive epic family saga, and now it's gone back to being super slick again. And I think because of the politics of the play, I think the journey that it's gone on has been really big, and in some ways you could argue that whenever in history this play is going to be written, like, that if you're developing this play over a 2-year period, there are always going to be loads of different things that will happen in that 2-year period that will massively change everyone's political interpretation of the play or the events that the writer feels should be foregrounded in it or whatever. But it does feel like the last 2 years have been perhaps more epically insane than a lot of other 2-year periods, like maybe in my lifetime. And I think definitely there's a conversation in the play about the need... Well, there's a conversation in the play about whether to take extreme action, basically. And part of that is about whether we as a society have become apathetic towards collective action. or not apathetic towards it, but just a bit jaded that maybe it doesn't matter how many people go on a march, the government don't care, or it doesn't matter how many people didn't vote Trump, he's still president, or whatever. I think over the last 2 years, a lot of people has shifted their dialogue in favour of going, maybe more extreme forms of political intervention perhaps need to happen. I think maybe what I've seen, I think there's a conversation around violent acts that I wouldn't say it's been like one clean jump from everyone suddenly. I thought there was a really interesting moment when Trump got elected where a lot of people I know who had gone died in the wall pacifist suddenly went, no, now's the time to go and punch Nazis. Mm. And that felt like a really big and quite I was going to say comprehensive shift, but then I think instantly with that comes the recognition of there is so much violence everywhere, there's such a prevalence of violence that does it actually need to be, this play explodes my brain. But yeah, I think in its development, definitely, I think the world that we're living in today feels more extreme and more dangerous, and like there is more imperative to take some form of action than maybe it did 2 years ago. I think 2 years ago, I feel like, really, like in my sort of really broad political analysis, you can really see why Brexit happened, because it was the sort of volcanic explosion of a lot of people feeling like nothing is ever going to change, nothing is ever going to get better. There's a sort of there's been a gradual crushing of a lot of people by a small majority that has happened over a long period of time, or there has been a gradual crushing of a lot of people within a system that seems inescapable. And Brexit felt like it was a lot of people just deciding to blow the roof off that, whatever the consequences. And so I can... Yeah, I think the biggest journey that the play's gone on is that I think that apathy and hopelessness felt much more the kind of daily mode 2 years ago, whereas now I think we're probably all in a state of like constant terror and panic rather than hopelessness, which is, yeah, you know, change is as good as a rest, isn't it? So it's quite hard to make plays when politics is going mental.
And does it sometimes feel like a frivolous thing to be doing when with everything else that's going on in the world? I ask this because I sometimes feel like what I'm doing is slightly frivolous or just kind of this kind of detached intellectual activity that's not making an impact when everything seems to be falling apart.
I think it feels frivolous all the time. And sometimes, like, the more political the content of your plays, the more frivolous it feels. But I think on a very personal level, I'm absolutely the kind of person who will frequently go, I should have been a doctor, I should have been a human rights lawyer, I need to quit theatre and do something useful. And I had a really brilliant conversation with someone a couple of years ago who was like, well, quit. I was like, I'm so bored of theatre makers going, I should do something useful. He was like, well, quit then. But actually, either just shut up and get on with it, or acknowledge that you love this and you're just going to carry on doing it, whatever. And I think it's really good to be idealistic and rigorous and responsible in how we think about our work. I think the most depressing way of thinking about it is, even if you're not making positive change in the world, you want to make sure that the work you're putting out in the world isn't creating negative impact. Mm. And I think I've always been really lucky in that I've worked with artists and theatres and institutions who have always been incredibly engaged with that kind of conversation. So it's not like people sit down and go, how will we make the world better through the use of this play? But you do absolutely have an examination of going, is this play inadvertently saying something really toxic? Is it inadvertently perpetuating some kind of horrific stereotype? Weirdly, the most clarity that I had this time last year when Trump got elected, we were in rehearsals for Panto at the Lyric. So I was associate director last year, this year I'm co-directing it. But the day that Trump got elected, I woke up in the morning and was like, I can't believe that what I'm going to do today is go into work and watch a load of young people dancing around to Justin Timberlake songs and that's how I'm spending my day in the aftermath of Trump. And then I thought, I thought, oh, I'm so glad that that's the show that I'm working on more than anything else, because Lyric Panto is amazing, and it so belongs to its community, and you get these massive audiences. They do this crazy amount of shows over Christmas. It's packed out every single show with families, with this hugely eclectic audience, a lot of people who don't normally go to the theatre, a lot of people who only come to Panto at Christmas, a lot of families, people of all different generations and walks of life. And you basically get all of those people together, and we all, it's an example of theatre makers needing to think really responsibly. You look at a pantomime like Aladdin, and the moral is basically, if you're poor, steal things and then you'll get a beautiful girlfriend. And like, the moral of Jack and the Beanstalk is, if you're poor, find someone who's huge, nick their things and kill them. And we always, in the making and development of it, have conversations about going, what is the actual message that we want our community to share in and to take away from this? And how is it that the communal experience of this story can be one that is incredibly positive in its gender stereotypes, in the way that it talks about people who aren't like us, in the way that it talks about what it is to have things and not to have things, in the way that it talks about what it is to be happy and what it is to find people that you love and care for, and what it is to come into conflict with people whose views don't line up with yours. And then you make all of that absolutely rock solid, and then you cover it all in glitter and songs, and you just present it to people, and you don't go, come and engage in a deep political conversation. You go, come and have an amazing Christmas where it snows and there's magic and sweets. But I suddenly went, that feels like the really, that feels like good stuff to be doing in theatre. That was pleasing.
I think the thing I also say to myself when I begin doubting the value of theatre, or of, you know, the kind of work that I do in connection to theatre, is I remember that the importance of stories and how much stories influence our perception of the world, and I've felt that really powerfully in the last few weeks, thinking about the kinds of stories that perpetuate a kind of toxic, misogynistic culture, and yep. what we can do to ensure that we're not retelling those stories. So that's possibly one way in which theatre, for all its apparent frivolity, is doing something really important. And I think that really speaks to what you were just saying about, if nothing else, ensuring that we're not kind of repeating stereotypes and repeating those toxic narratives.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's, again, it, like, you could sort of go, well, like, in an ideal world, no one would be putting out toxic narratives, and therefore we wouldn't have to go, well, we need to work in theatre to detoxify them. But also, human beings, we love stories. We love storytelling, whether it's, you know, TV or film or theatre or any other kinds of the arts, even things like music and... We love to be able to express ourselves. We love to be able to watch others express themselves and to share in that, and to, you know, see things outside of our own experience, or to see our own experience exactly distilled. And I think, like you say, there's a real, particularly present at the moment, is a real need to examine the way that our industry is structured, but also the stories that are being put out.
I wanted to ask you about theatrical representation and what seems to me like an interest in that in your work. And this perhaps also relates to similar questions around the way in which we tell those stories and the form that those stories take. And so I think the first thing of yours that I saw was, I'm going to have to check the full title, I'd rather Goya rob me of my sleep than some other arsehole. The thing that I really clearly remember about it was that, you know, the two piglets that played the children of the protagonist, and which was just a really striking and interesting choice. And it seems to me that throughout your work you're thinking a lot about how things are represented and what the possibilities might be there, and also perhaps the kind of the politics of that. Is that kind of a fair interpretation, do you think?
Yeah, totally. I think it's something that I'm thinking a lot about at the moment, because I think, like, the Goya thing with the pigs felt definitely like the sort of clearest distillation of that idea and that interest for me. I think it's possibly a combination of being incredibly literal and incredibly lazy, that I've got this weird distrust of things that are pretend, or just I really like that element of realness. And if I've always loved theatre that that doesn't just show you what the world looks and sounds like, but it tries to make you experience what it feels like or what it is. I think I had this really pivotal moment at school. We were studying Waiting for Godot, and I just remember my teacher going, the thing about the experience of seeing, or indeed trying to study this play, is that it's really boring and tedious and confusing, and every so often you think that you've understood what's going on and then you just don't anymore. And it's sort of quite funny, but also really excruciating and a bit depressing. And that's what it was like to be alive just after the Second World War. And I was like, oh. And so she was like, what you feel when you're experiencing the play is a feeling. I think it was her interpretation and whatever, but she was like, it's trying to give you an experience rather than trying to show you someone else's experience. Primarily, or rather than trying to tell you what to think. And I think, so when it came to Goya, I was like, I'm interested in depicting his children, like what the function of the children are in that play, is that you've got a man who's really struggling, and really struggling to understand how to function in the world and why he's alive in the world, and I think he's probably suicidal, and yet he's been left in charge of these two children. And the way that his kids function in the play is that they are at times all he has to live for, and there are other times completely soul destroying, and they do that thing to him that children do, where they'll come and hold your hand and you feel like your heart is melting, and then they'll sort of, you know, snot on your knee and walk off. And so I felt like that was the thing that they're the most doing to him in the play. So I was like, well, I mean, you couldn't put children in this play anyway because the language is obscene, but I felt like that having children would have sort of clouded it, because you're watching children watching children obediently say their lines and act, but you're sort of watching child actors be really obedient, whereas what it wanted was something that was alive, but would be completely unpredictable and would screw him over all the time. And then I was on a farm, just because I did grow up in the countryside, and sometimes you go to farms when you go home, and there were all these piglets running around, and I just looked at them and went, his kids are pigs. And then I kept saying to people as a semi-joke, but people who had read the play sort of went, I weirdly get what you mean. And then I just ended up with a brilliantly nutter producer who let me do it. But I think it felt like they would serve the correct function in that play if they were those things. And it was really interesting, because obviously you have this really practical conversation going, if you can't afford them, what are they? And you're going, well, whatever they are, they're not children. You're sort of going, if they're not pigs, then they're plants or something. They're something that you can crush very easily. But what I also found exciting about that is, because it is a metaphor or a symbol or whatever, people then start to lay a meaning onto it that might have served you getting there. I definitely had things about going, the children in the play are really intelligent, and we think of pigs as being really clever, and there's definitely something about capitalism and people kind of like having their nose in the trough, or people rolling around in pig shit or whatever. But there was a great moment when I spoke to someone, because the play was written in Spain around the time of the financial crisis, actually before the financial crisis really hit in Spain, but we were staging it at the gate after that. And someone went, oh, well, obviously, because, you know, the pigs countries like Portugal, Ireland, Greece and Spain, that's why you've chosen them. I was like, I'll take that, sure. Yeah, I think that got me on the track of going, I find that sort of search for how to stage something quite useful. I think it's something that I'm sort of grappling with in my head at the moment, going, I don't have like a hard and fast rule. I'm not like, no lies on stage, because then I'd be making performance art. Like, I think I am okay with people acting and pretending things. I think there is real power in that as an art form. And that sort of constructed reliving of an experience over and over and over and over again for an audience who aren't living it themselves. But I find the idea of making the audience the protagonist of a piece of work really interesting. And I think that one of the ways that you can do that is assure them that there is reality on stage. When you're watching Piglets, you know that it's not, that there is that element of chaos. You know that the actor doesn't quite know when the pig is going to piss on his foot. Although they did get into a bit of a routine with it. And we did a similar thing with Layla and Co, which is about sex trafficking, where there's a scene in which she describes what's been done to her, and again working with the designer and the rest of the team, I was like, it doesn't, partly sort of that question about responsible representation, I was like, it doesn't feel at all valuable or responsible or interesting to me to depict what it would look like if a 15-year-old girl was locked in a small room and raped twice a day for a year. I don't think that you can depict the horror of that by putting a young woman on stage and showing her in whatever kind of a state. But also it doesn't feel like that's going to make the audience understand any at all what that might feel like. And so what we did was, as she's starting to describe the stuff beginning to happen to her, we just took the auditorium into complete blackout and it stayed in it for about 20 minutes. And so a lot of the play happens in complete darkness because it gives people that sense of isolation and fear and not knowing when the lights are going to be turned back on and not quite knowing who's around them, that is, again, nowhere near what the experience of that actual person was. But it does something to people that felt like a more valuable thing to put into the production at that point.
You've been talking quite a bit about that kind of journey towards working out what feels like it works and what feels like it creates a particular experience for the audience. And I know that you're in the new year, you're directing Trust at the Gate Theatre. So you're kind of, I suppose you're early in that process of working that out. Would you be happy to chat a bit about that play and where you're at with it at the moment?
Yeah, sure. I mean, where I'm at with it is quite exciting because I just have no idea how to direct it. I've got some ideas, like get a really good team together and then just do some work on it. And I've got ideas about... So I think why it fits in the gate, what's really exciting is that we programmed it, and then obviously watching the rest of the season unfold, like I knew what shows were going to be in the season, but actually the experience of going to watch them has been so exciting, and it feels like what Ellen's really nailing with the gate. And one of the things that the gate has always kind of had in its DNA is it is a space for the audience as community. It's quite a... intimate space for people to explore things that are quite challenging together, either because it's just incredibly up close and personal, or because I think you can explore things that are quite intellectually knotty. Because I don't know, maybe that's stupid, like because it's small, but I think there's something about the intimacy of that that allows you to make work that can feel quite specific and quite esoteric, and that you can really take people on quite a complex journey. And it's been great watching. I watched Susie Stork the other night, and it has this really clear relationship to Unknown Island in this, there is a real ask from the performers to the audience in order to help them work stuff through, and to be there with them in moments of extreme hardship, that we're definitely going to have in Trust. So Trust, I read it probably about, I don't know, it must have been like a year and a half ago, and I was like, it's a really interesting play, and I had read a bit of Falk Richter's work before. Again, it sort of floats my boat as a director, because I think the challenge is exciting, because formally it's not a naturalistic play, it's not a kind of start to finish narrative. It tends to be this sort of really exciting montage of thought, and I think he makes work with this real trust in the audience's ability and desire to piece things together for themselves. And I read the play and thought, okay, it's really exciting. It sort of draws a parallel between breakups and the emotional pain of breaking up with somebody, because you have that incredibly complex mixture of the desire to be with them, the desire to be with just anyone at all, and the desire to not be with them. And then it sort of sets that up in relationship to our relationship as a society with capitalism. And I read it and thought, it's really exciting, potentially quite challenging for a British audience, and it also something that is terrifying, because you go, it's a void in my head, I don't know how to make it. Sometimes that's exciting, and other times I read it and go, I am stupid and I have no idea. And other moments you just go, at that point we'll all get pissed and burst into song. And then Brexit happened, and then Ellen and I spoke, and we were like, right, now is absolutely the time in Britain, in what will it be like, 2018, to be staging a play that is about a breakup and about economic systems. And then sort of coincidentally, I ended a relationship around a similar time that we were having the conversation, and it really struck me that when you're yeah, that as soon as you think about it in terms of, as soon as you think about a breakup in terms of going, well, 52% of you wants to leave and 48% of you wants to remain, you start to see some really depressing parallels. But it felt like there was something, it felt like, suddenly it felt like an incredibly urgent thing to put in front of a British audience. Mm-hmm. Because I think there's a, for example, within the, whatever we are, like the lefty elite, I'm not sure what the like acronym probably is, but you know, left-wing theatre makers, like I would say like a huge proportion of Remain voters, I think that both the intellectual and economic and whatever, like political side of thinking of it, but also having the really strong emotional thing of going in terms of identity, in terms of feeling very emotionally connected to the notion of being European, it feels exciting to dive into a play that is actually incredibly knotty about going, just because you didn't want to leave an institution doesn't mean that it's perfect. And I think that in the way that everything gets simplified, because you had to just pick a side and say yes or no, because we ended up in this insane situation where, for example, if Jeremy Corbyn goes, I'm 7 out of 10 in favour, everyone's like, what's wrong with you? Be 15 out of 10 in favour. You're like, well, now it's happened. Like, now we're all, you know, irretrievably fucked anyway. We might as well really examine the nuance and the complexity of what the EU is as a capitalist system and what it means to be leaving it.
Theatre Voice is an audio archive about British theatre. You can subscribe to the weekly podcast on iTunes or visit our website, theatrevoice.com, to find hundreds of recordings with some of the world's leading theatre makers. This episode was hosted by Catherine Love and produced by Matt Truman and Helen Gush for the Victoria and Albert Museum. Thanks for listening.